Welcome to Modern Ancestral Mamas, a podcast for mamas created by mamas. We discuss ancestral food, cooking, feeding our families, and holistic living with the everyday modern mom.
We are Corey and Christine, two mamas on a mission to nourish our families holistically while keeping it real in today's crazy world. Follow us on this adventure and enjoy the stories and information we share.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Modern Ancestral Mamas. I am Christine from Nourish the Littles, and I'm joined by my co-host Corey from For Nutrient Sake. And we are back today with another fascinating guest to discuss the subject of lovingly connecting with our families and nourishing them both emotionally and physically. And today's guest is someone that I personally have been a huge fan of for several years, ever since I read her first book, Rest, Play, Grow. And she just came out with a new book recently titled Nourished. And this book was absolutely incredible. I have told many people about it. I felt that it was very, it was revolutionary when it comes to feeding kids. And I absolutely had to have her on. So Corey and I are thrilled to have Dr. Deborah McNamara on. And she is a counselor, a mother, and author of her two books, Rest, Play, Grow, and Nourished, Connection, Food, and Caring for Our Kids and Everyone Else We Love. She is on the faculty at the Newfield Institute, and she loves translating developmental science into practical love. So welcome, Deborah.
Thank you so much. And I'm so delighted that you love Nourish. So, and Rest, Play, Grow. That's music to my ears. So thanks for having me.
Okay. So we usually start the show with a roundtable question. So we'll all answer this. And Christine was telling me that she realized that you enjoy trying out new recipes, even on guests, which is bold. So what is a new recipe that you have tried recently, whether it was a hit or not?
Well, I typically go through, if I get a new cookbook or, you know, on Instagram or something, but my latest was looking at some of the recipes on the New York Times cooking tab. And so I recently cooked a oven chicken shawarma, which was pretty good. Yum. And then today, actually, I cooked a Thai inspired chicken meatball soup, and oh my gosh, it is a keeper. So it was lovely.
A soup. Say that again. It was a Thai
inspired chicken meatball soup.
Oh,
chicken. Yeah, meatball. It was so good.
Also on the New York Times?
Yeah, New York Times. I think that's okay. Exactly the name of the recipe, Thai inspired.
Okay.
Meatball soup.
I borrow someone's New York Times subscription, and but I use it all the time. It's actually one of the websites I go to the most, aside from Serious Eats. Yeah. So, but yeah.
That's wonderful.
Okay, what about you, Corey? Oh, you want me to go? Oh, geez.
Yeah, I want you to go.
No, you don't want to hear what I have.
Yeah, yes, we do. No.
Well, because I just tried a brand new one tonight.
Okay, I know what this is, and yeah. I have made this as well.
Oh, you have? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So this was actually, which made me laugh even more because you mentioned this in your book, Deborah, but I made tonight a steak and kidney tartlette. Deborah has a paragraph in her book where she talks about being fed steak and kidney pie by her mother and how she despised it.
Yikes.
Just the kidney, the chewy bits.
Totally, totally. Yeah. But yeah, that's what I made tonight. And I personally don't like kidney either, Deborah. It's been a work in progress for me to learn to love this very nutrient-dense food. And tonight was the first night that I said, oh my gosh, this was delicious. I would eat this again.
Good for you.
So, I don't know. It was hit or miss. Two of my three kids liked it. But two of my three kids asked me to never cook with kidney again. So
I don't love kidney. That is the only way I've had kidney that was palatable. And yeah, that recipe is pretty good. Okay. We should just mention really fast that recipe is from Awfully Good Cooking, which, you know, we've had Janine on the show, and she's got incredible organ meat recipes. And okay. So for me, what is one I've made recently? This wasn't the most recent new things, but I've been on a pan sauce kick instead of gravy, making pan sauces, and particularly putting in Dijon mustard. And it's just like, my mouth is so happy just thinking about it. Like, it's so good. And you know what is insane to me? My children don't like gravy. I don't know what is wrong with them.
Oh man. Yeah. What is wrong with them?
I don't know. But Ryan and I like lick it. I'm like, I can't get enough of this. Yeah, they don't even have it with mashed potatoes. They're strange. Okay, so Deborah, would you take a couple minutes just to share your backstory with us, give our listeners a little more information, how you got to where you're at, that sort of thing?
Sure. Well, I went to my primary education is a counselor, essentially. But I'm also a teacher. So I worked in a university setting where I was both a counselor and a teacher, instructor, professor, and primarily worked in the area of education and understanding human development. And eventually I had my own child, and I went looking for the latest developmental science to help me understand what to do with things like temper tantrums, resistance, and opposition. And that's when I found Gordon Neufeld. For those of you who don't know who Gordon Neufeld is, he's one of the world's leading developmental relational theorists, and not just theory, but research and practice. And so he was also in clinical practice and puts together really unique pieces of information that oftentimes people just look at one at a time rather than how they are all meant to come together. So, for example, understanding attachment, but it's not just about attachment. It's also about how maturation occurs and how we grow up and how we grow our kids up. It's also about our emotions and what do we do with the, you know, complex array of human emotions that our kids have, that we have. What do we do with these? How do we help our kids grow to become more mature? It's about, you know, neuroscience and understanding how the brain develops. It's about respecting cultural tradition and that we've been raising kids for a very long time, long before there were, you know, psychologists and experts in parenting, before there was Instagram and Google. And we've been raising kids for a very long time. And so there is a set of, you know, instincts and emotions that guide us as parents. And so it really brings all these pieces together. And I studied with him when I had my first child, which was close to about 20 years ago, and quit my academic position at the university and went to work in his institute called the Neufeld Institute. And so I teach, I counsel, I run a counseling practice, and I work with educators and professionals to help make sense of kids. But my favorite is really working with parents to help them make sense of their children, because parents are incredible in terms of the power that they have and the care and the love that they have for a child. And so it's my real passion and purpose to work and walk alongside parents and respect what they bring to the table. You know, I think I have a very different approach to my work, which is to help a parent take the driver's seat in a child's life and walk beside them that way, not believing that parents need experts, but parents need to find the expert inside of them. And so I think it's quite distinct in that way. In fact, we try not to answer too many parenting questions, but we do. But we try to help the parent find the answers inside themselves.
Wow, that resonates so much with me. I absolutely love that. That's something that I think is lost in today's culture, is this idea of parents are the experts of their own children. And I think it's because we're saturated with information and there are so many experts everywhere that we forget that, you know, we have that power within us.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And when it becomes a business, it puts other things in the mix, right? you know, so this is a bit of a challenge. So I'm a developmentalist, and basically what that means is I study, research, and try to make sense of the conditions that we need to create so that our children can thrive, believing that nature hardwired them up with these human potentials and that we have a role to play in that. And so what is it that we can do that only we can do as the adults in a child's life? What is it that we can do, what we can provide that makes sure that that ability to become resilient and resourceful and adaptive and to become someone who is has compassion for others, is considerate, has empathy, does the right thing when nobody's looking, you know, becomes their own person, full of their own goals, their own ideas and their own initiatives, and finds their own talents and gifts and is able to pursue those with courage. I think, you know, most parents would say they want their kids to be happy and to be fulfilled. And so that's what I stand for, is what is it that we have to do this way? And what are the things we shouldn't work at? Because we work at a lot of things we really shouldn't be working at. And so I take a developmental approach, which is different from a lot that's out there, to be honest. And so there's some distinctives that come with it. But one of them is just basically understanding that attachment and the purpose of attachment is to ensure that a child depends upon their adult and that the adult can take the lead in taking care of them. Obviously, giving a child autonomy where it's appropriate, but that this is a position of a parent being a caring and firm leader in a child's life.
When you say that there's other positions, are you referring to, for example, like a behaviorist model or...
Yeah, a behavioral model would assume that you would basically teach and sculpt and consequence, bribes, threats, punishment in order to grow a child up, that with the right lessons, one somehow becomes mature. There's a lot of immature people that had all the right lessons and didn't grow, because growth is about emotions. It's about human attachment and how they come together. A large part of the brain basically is dedicated to processing human emotion. And that's what drives overall development. And so this idea that you're going to teach, you know, from the outside in, doesn't understand these inner springs to growth and development. It absolutely pretends they're invisible and don't exist. So it's a very diametric, you know, it's a very opposite way of looking at how people grow.
Hmm. Okay. Would you next give us a brief overview of your book, Nourished? So your second book, the newest one, right? Yeah. Just like a kind of quick look at it for those of us who haven't read it.
Sure. It actually came about because I never intended really to write a book about food and human connection. First of all, it's... My kids said to me, "Mom, you're writing about food?" Like, no.
Oh, love their support.
Anyway, so I'm like, no, I'm not telling people how to cook. You know, this is not my job this way. I'm writing about something that we've forgotten. Now, the only reason that I came upon this as a subject matter is my 3-year-old, I didn't understand at the time, but had a very sensitive palate, you know, chemical sensing system. So from her nose to her mouth to her whole, you know, gut, was just quite sensitive to texture, food, smells, this kind of thing. And I didn't understand that. My first one was very easy to feed. My second one, I'm like, where did you come from? And I grew quite frustrated. You know, she earned, you know, we gave her the label of picky, which I wouldn't do now. And I went to Gordon Neufeld, my mentor at the time, and asked him, what am I supposed to do about this kid who doesn't eat? And really what was going on was that I was creating a relationship problem because I had labeled her as picky and I was pushing food on her and she was becoming more resistant and oppositional, which, I became more persistent and pushy. And so here I was, as a mother, creating a relationship problem when everything that I did and taught and helped other families with was human relationships. So I'm like, I better figure this out. And Gordon Neufeld refused to answer my question. He didn't like my question, and he was right not to, which was essentially, how do I get this kid to eat vegetables? Which is, as you know, number one questions, I'm sure, you know, in a survey done of parents, I think it was 2021, there was, you know, these were the common questions of, you know, how do I get them to eat nutritious food, eat healthy food, try new foods? And yet what I realize now after many years of research and writing is we're asking the wrong questions. I was asking the wrong questions. And so that's what opened up the doorway to this book. So that's the beginning of it. So what is the book actually about? It's about how food has become divorced from the relationships that were meant to be part of it. So food is happening now in a context that is divorced of attachment. We don't look at it this way. I mean, I think some people intuitively get it, but it's like, we're so worried about what's in our food, what food to serve, how to get our kids eat, how to get them to eat the right food, that we've forgotten that the fundamental thing that our kids need most of all, that makes our caretaking possible, is human relationship. And it's through relationship that our kids are made receptive to our care. You can't take care of a child who isn't following you, who doesn't trust you, who doesn't lean on you, who doesn't depend upon you. And so we treat food as this sort of, let's, you know, take care of the body over here. Food is fuel. Food is, you know, all about nutrition. Well, of course it's about nutrition, but we, you know, we sell it short. Feeding someone is the greatest love story we have. And yet we don't treat it that way. And so we separate out caring for the body. Then we do caring for the heart and the mind, and they all come together as part of our feeding relationship. Let me put it to you this way. I did some research. I went down all sorts of blind alleys and avenues. It was quite a fun project, actually. That's why it took me about 10 years to write this. Also because I'm a parent and work full-time and have two children. That slowed me down a little. The housework never bothered me so much, but the kids slowed me down a little bit. But think about it this way. I researched animals that could go the longest without food. And I found camels, bears hibernate. We're in my neck of the woods. Lots of bears hibernate in the winter, you know, 3-4 months. You have desert frogs. I'm not sure how long they go, but the longest animal, I think there's a snake or so that is about 2 years. But the longest I found was a water bear that lives on moss. It's microscopic. It can go 30 years without food and water. So just imagine that, not feeding your child. Now, I know some parents would be like, oh my gosh, sign me up. But I just want to enhance the problem is, how can you take care of someone that you only see every 30 years? That is not the making for good relationships. I think nature was purposeful in her intentions and her design for us, in that our stomachs empty often and much, so that we have to return to the people we are most connected to, who we rely on for survival, that helps our emotions and gives us a sense of belonging and purpose. The French playwright Leon Abric said, the immortal gods, you know, why do the immortal gods show up at the table and twice a day? They're immortal. They don't need to eat. But why do they show up at the table? Because they hunger for something that is also more significant. It's about belonging, connection. It's about emotional safety. And so that's really the crux of the book, is how food can serve our human relationships. And we need to stop. Well, we are worried already about what food to serve. So we can just press pause on that for a little bit and change the question a little bit. So that's what the whole book is about, how to change the question, how to change the lens.
Okay. First of all, so many things that I want to comment on. First thing being, I appreciate so much that you came to this with the lens of a parent, that it was your parenting, your own parenting struggles that brought you to, you know, helping others. And I find it so frustrating when, you know, these experts or whoever come out and have all these opinions on parenting when they've never had children. That is one of my biggest pet peeves. So, or even when they've had, you know, really easy children. And then secondly, I think that I know when I had just my oldest two, we didn't do a very good job of making meals a connection point. We lived in a really, really small apartment. We didn't have space for a table. We literally had the kids sat on the floor with this like floor height table, and my husband and I would sit on the couch, and it wasn't really an interactive sort of situation with the meals. And I realized at some point we were at one of our family members' house with having, you know, a family dinner, and my kids didn't know how to basically behave at the table because they'd never been in that situation before. And it was like a very eye-opening situation. And I realized, oh my gosh, like we are not doing a good job teaching them how to be in relationship with other people at a meal. So we changed that in our home. But I just, oh man, so much to dive into. Christine, did you want to say anything?
No, I loved everything I heard. And I agree with you that one of the number one questions I get asked all the time in my DMs is, how can I get my child to eat X, Y, and Z? Mm-hmm. And so I understand the lens that you are coming from and just how desperately we need the book that you wrote. Just so that we can change the conversation and specifically the question, like you said, because it's we need a mindset shift. Totally. There was one quote in the book that said, we have become so focused on what food to serve. I'm guilty that we have lost sight of how food was meant to serve relationships. And I was wondering if you could, you did touch on it a little bit already, but if you wanted to just elaborate a little bit more on that quote.
Yeah, thanks. Well, when I was trying to distill everything, you know, and put it all together, because it's such a messy field. Like I've, you know, studied lots of different areas, you know, human development to neuroscience to emotions and trying to put those pieces together. But this is a messy area. Like it's like someone just went in and threw food at the wall and just it's everywhere and it doesn't connect. You've got eating disorders in one area, picky eating in another, nutrition and cookbooks and happy family meals in another, and, you know, memoirs about anorexia in another. And it's just like they're not disconnected. They actually need to be. You have to put the pieces of this puzzle back together again that has fallen apart since culture, you know, has been lost and used to direct so much of our eating. And I think actually in many ways what this book is about is restoring, is trying to grasp the understanding of culture, of what we've lost in the cultural food ways that basically protected human relationships and provided for human relationships and inclusion and communities. But this idea of, you know, we've become so focused on what food to serve and have forgotten how it serves human relationships. I spent a whole chapter, I could have spent a whole book on attachment, but I spent one chapter really going hard at it, and where it's titled What Maslow Got Wrong. And I remember when I first started doing presentations on this many years ago, it occurred to me, I don't know, just out of the, not out of the blue, but I'm just, you know, I always knew relationship was important working with Gordon, but that somehow, you know, everybody buys into Maslow's hierarchy that food is the number one thing required for survival. Now, I know that makes sense when you think about the human body and not being able to survive without food and blah, blah, blah. But the reality is, when you look at how the brain is organized, the thing that comes first that grabs your attention, that is hardwired in at birth, is a separation protest and a pursuit for connection. It is when it is these things that actually become the survival instinct, because attachment is the number one. It wasn't food. It's never been food or any of these other things for survival. Attachment in human relationships. Why? Because the people who are attached to you and you to them, you're most receptive to their care and they're most inclined to take care of you and want you to survive. Why would anyone share their resources? Why would anybody share their food? Why would anyone potentially put their life on their line for another human being? It only makes sense when you think about it through the lens of human connection. Nature wired us up to take care of each other, because in that taking care of each other, we have the maximum chance of survival. We're not the fastest. We don't have the biggest teeth. We're not the strongest, but we have each other. And it is that strength and togetherness that allows for our survival. And in our relationship to the land, our history and our people, to all the living creatures. And so this idea of togetherness, of human relationship, it has to come first and foremost. A quick example that I give, like in the book, and by the way, Maslow actually was, I didn't know this until I discovered this in my research. He was actually a traumatized child. His parents were horrible to him. He created a whole hierarchy out of his own deprivation. Mm. He put love third because he had so very little of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is where we must always challenge and look into the psychology of the expert to say, oh my goodness, what is driving their perspective and on the world as one human being? They don't lie checked oftentimes by a culture that says, no, that's not, you know, practice. That doesn't make sense. But one of the examples here, oh, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. I was talking about why.
An example from the book.
Yeah, I was, you know, the idea of the oxygen mask on the plane, that was one of them, right. You know, where we always say, oh, well, you've got to put your oxygen mask on first. Well, yes, but the purpose is to actually, so you can take care of somebody else. You can't have a child or anyone else who's, you know, deprived of oxygen, be able to get themselves off a plane. And so this idea of, well, we got to do self-care. That's what Maslow actually got really wrong, is it's not self-care. It's actually so that you can pick yourself up and take care of somebody else, and someone else takes care of you, and so on and so forth. But when it comes to parent and child, our job is to take care of the ones who are dependent upon us. But we've created a whole system in believing that food comes first, and it's a boon for food marketers. It's a boon for anyone in the nutrition business. It's a boon for all of this, where food becomes a commodity to be consumed. It's an absolute wonderful cash crop in this respect. But there's something more pressing that has always hijacked our attention, and that is human relationship. If you can feed a child at school, and we have wonderful food policy programs which try to give kids, you know, food, especially those that are struggling with food poverty and insecurity, you know, a hot lunch program or breakfast program, how we do it really matters. I think there's some really problematic areas that way, which is dehumanizing and doesn't respect the dignity of a child and what this means. But aside from that, the idea of feeding a child who is going hungry through school programs, I think, is a wonderful idea. But the argument for it is, well, it's going to raise test scores and, you know, help them concentrate, because if they have fuel, then they'll be able to concentrate. Well, food is a part of that, but there's actually something more critical that will hijack your attention, and that is a lack and a loss of human connection, because it's that connection which helps you feel safe. And so there's all sorts of implications here in putting food first. It's been a big mistake, and I am not surprised that every eating person, eating specialist, eating disordered, nutritionist, dietitians that I spoke to as part of this research said in North America, every single individual has some sort of challenged relationship with food today, which I think is very much true.
So there's an individual that we are probably going to reference throughout this episode, and I actually think that the two of you would benefit greatly from having a conversation together. But so Mary Ruddick is an anthropologist who has actually gone and lived with the last remaining traditional cultures in the world and studied them. And we had her on recently, and one of the things that she talked about was the relationship between the tribal members, the community members, and their love for each other and their attachment to each other, and how that affects their hormones their hormonal balance. And of course, food is a part of this. And these are family members that community members that always eat together, that are sharing food with each other, literally, you know, putting it in each other's mouths. So there's, you know, the discussion of the microbiome and how that helps each other's microbiome. And I just, I can't help but think, as I was reading your book, I couldn't help but also think of what she had, you know, shared with us from her research and her travels. And one of the things that I think I'm struggling with, and I'm hoping that you can help me understand, is in that situation, that is a perfect situation. These are people that are eating food that is whole from the earth. They've hunted, they've gathered, mm-hmm. maybe they've grown it, you know, that kind of thing. And there is no, they don't have to worry about health issues or anything like that, because there is no propaganda or marketing or, you know, or laboratory produced food and stuff like that. So like that is a perfect situation. But in a world that we have today where, you know, like you said, food has become a commodity, and nutrition, and like, you know, the type of work that I'm in, that's a commodity, obviously. How does that work with this idea of putting relationship first when all of the food that we're eating is, it's not real food? So, mm-hmm. you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not real food. It's, mm-hmm. it is affecting our gut microbiome. It is affecting the, you know, depleting our body of nutrients and creating imbalances in our, you know, mineral status, and all of that plays into the foods that we crave, our emotions. Obviously, you know, I loved that you went into the gut microbiome. You had a, you know, a whole section on that, whole chapter. And yeah, that's what I'm trying to, understand, is how do you reconcile that?
Well, this is a brilliant question, actually, and it can't be reconciled. We can find an answer to it, but there is no fixing what has come undone. You know, Mary Ruddick's work sounds absolutely fascinating. I wish I'd found it before, as part of the research. I actually had to stop researching because I'm like, oh my gosh, I'll die before I ever finish all the book. But she sounds fascinating. I'd love to take her out for dinner and just pick her brains. What an absolute treat to go and find in the intact cultures and to capture what is so endangered and so is absolutely being lost. So that is now, that is what is natural, but is no longer normal. And so we're living in something that is normal, but is no longer natural. It's been lost. That wisdom has been broken. We now have to find our way back through consciousness. And that's what my whole book is about. It's about being conscious of asking different questions, of seeing that we're in trouble. Like people say, well, what's the way forward? Well, we have to first realize we have a problem. You know, we need people to tell us, hey, that's not food. It may look like food, smell like food, but that's not good for you, because we don't have that being passed down. We don't have that knowledge anymore. So it is now in the hands of science. It is now in the hands of, you know, a consumer driven society. Like, this is just the reality in which we live. So we have to live with ethics in how we do that, and how I feel about that. Because, you know, your mamas and your aunties and people used to tell you how to raise your kids. So the way that I try to deal with the ethics of that is to try to make myself redundant, and to get people to say, my client, I say to them, my goal is for you to fire me and to just no longer need me. That is the ethics in which I do my job. So when you empower a parent to make decisions for their children by educating them in terms of what has been lost, I think that's absolutely necessary today. There has to be a consciousness through which we talk about these things and we bring a different lens to the table to try to replace what has been lost and is sometimes not even recognized, what has been lost. We're not going back to that idyllic state. Those intact cultures have probably a time limit on them in terms of what they're able to even, one of the questions I'd ask Mary Ruddick is how many of them are still left intact? Because I bet they're endangered and they're quickly being lost. So we have to become conscious. And in that sense, we need to empower caretakers to be the answer to what food our children eat. And this is where I think we're taking a huge wrong turn, is that I think in our knee-jerk reaction to get our kids to eat better, we put them far too much more responsible for these choices or educating them too much. Our actions, what we introduce them to, how we shape their palate, how we talk about food that we enjoy at the table, and, you know, just general conversation, children are so receptive to that. And they will go on to copy, imitate, and adopt the food ways that we have brought them into. It was interesting the U.S. government enlisted the help of an anthropologist and a psychologist, Kurt Lewin and Margaret Mead, and they said, we need to get people to eat different food, in particular the offals, because, you know, that you animals have kidneys and livers and things like that that need to be eaten. And they were shipping so much of the food to people who are on the front lines. And so they needed people to change what they were eating so that we could, use food more effectively. And so they Kurt Lewin and Margaret Mead did a study to say, how do we change people's food habits? And what they came back with were the resounding answer was, you have to get to the caretakers. The caretakers are the ones who are the gatekeepers to the home. And it's no surprise to me that those gatekeepers are constantly battered in terms of that they don't know what is best, that so much of a campaign is targeted at them, undermining what they know. I think, you know, in a research study, 2021, the International Food Council, I think it was, with like 1,200 parents, they asked them, do you know what to feed your kids? And 87% of them said, yeah, we have a pretty good idea of what kind of foods are best to feed our kids, but we don't know how to get them to eat it. That was 70%. We don't know how to get them to eat it. So, consciousness is what's required now. There's no going back. It is broken. We just have to go forward and to think things through and to ask different questions and to take the lead and to not forget that caretakers are the answers here. Parents are the answers. Anyone who's responsible for feeding a child is the answer this way, and they need to be empowered in their role to take the lead and to make those decisions about what food is really important and to do the education there for sure. So that they can proceed forward in the child's best interest or their family's best interest.
So you mentioned, you know, trying to be kind of, I don't know if natural is the right way to say it, but like not pushy about the way that you're educating your kids about food. How could you give us a kind of breakdown, a practical breakdown on, how do you do this with infants? How do you do this with toddlers? How do you do this with elementary age? How do you do this with older kids? You know, because I would assume that there's a difference in the way that you're doing this with different ages.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. I get asked this, I think, almost every podcast, to be honest with you. What does this look? And that's not a complaint. It's just, it's the question that comes up next. Well, what does this look like? I had my nephew over to visit me. He was 18 months and I was taking care of him while everyone else went skiing over the winter holidays here. And, I don't know what he ate. My sister-in-law didn't really give me any information. So which is fine. I mean, you know, he eats food. So I remembered back to the days when I had an 18-month-old and I thought, well, apple's a safe bet. So I just got an apple, set him on my lap and started to cut up an apple in small slices and, you know, give him a slice of it. And so he took it from me because he loves me, of course, and I love him dearly. And he puts it in his mouth and he takes a bite with, I don't know how many teeth he's got. Not many, but he's got a few. And then he takes a bite and he starts to chew it. And then, you know, I'm looking at him. Is he going to choke? What's he capable of? What does this kid know about food? I'm just like, you know, on waiting here. And then he takes the other little bit that he's got in his hand. He shoves it in my mouth.
Oh.
And then I go, oh, yummy. So yummy. And I eat my apple. How rude it would be of me to refuse. And then I cut up another little piece and I put it in his mouth. And then he takes a bite and he puts the rest in mine. I would suggest to you, that's kind of the template. Like, if my daughter comes out of her bedroom, you know, she's 10. What are you making, Mom? Oh, you know, carrot muffins. Oh, you never made those before. Yeah. Can I have one? Of course you can. You can have as many as you want. Did you put cinnamon in there? Yeah, honey. I know you like cinnamon. Oh, okay. Like, it's food is a gift. Like, I don't focus on healthy, bad, you know, nutritional. I never, ever, ever gave my kids a nutritional food chart. I don't think I could probably even get one right if you asked me. To be honest with you, am I thoughtful about what my kids eat? Yes, absolutely. Did I try to give them the most natural, best food that I could afford? Absolutely. Were there treats? Absolutely. You know, it was a very relaxed but diligent, environment around food. But don't kid yourself. I was absolutely in the lead. Of what came into this house or what they ate and where they ate, but did so from a place of caring and being a strong caretaker. So we have, you know, my daughter didn't like meat, wouldn't eat meat, hated meat. So, you know, I gave up battling her and I researched stuff on high protein and adapted our diet. So when I made butter chicken for one kid, I put edamames on the table for her. My kids didn't realize that that was kind of a fusion meal with butter chicken edamames. That's just how we ate it, right? And we enjoyed it. And, you know, we talked about lots of stuff. And, oh, is this a good batch? And I love this. And, oh, did you try this? And, oh, yeah, you like a little bit more of this. And my husband said, yeah, and I'm going to make some, you know, ribs this weekend. He's the carnivore, you know, on his barbecue. And, you know, and we just celebrated it, you know. We have a pizza oven. My husband bought me a pizza oven. It's like, oh, you know, just everybody, we come together, we just make our own pizzas. And, you know, we just enjoy and we celebrate. And people are trying, you know, hot peppers on this or chicken or pineapple on this. And it's just, what are you doing? What are you doing? Oh, interesting. I never thought of that. It's just so... there's such an invitation for everybody to just discover, play, and enjoy. And I just trust that what I put on the table and what I provide is the provision is good. And I trust that they will, you know, take what they need. Very much Alan Satter's division responsibility. But when you add the relationship to it, it's, you know, if my kids lost their appetite, if they didn't seem settled or rested when it came to food, then my spidey sense would not be to go to the food. It would be to go to, well, what happened? What stirred them up? What's going on in their life? Is it something in the day? Is it something at this table? How do I make sense of this? And so it's hard to describe something that's invisible, but I hope you get the idea here that there's warmth, there's delight, there's connection. There's not a focus explicitly on food. There isn't a hurry up, coercion, resistance, you know, eat your carrots or you'll go blind. There's a sense of relationship, a sense of connection, a sense of celebration, a sense of rest when we're around our food. Even if I'm having a picnic in the car with a kid or driving, you know, to a soccer match with a smoothie for them, there's a sense of just trying to connect and have a conversation. Oh, how did you, you know, like that? I put extra strawberries in there for you today. And I'm constantly taking those quiet notes about what each kid likes. This kid likes more garlic or cinnamon. This kid likes more blueberry. I got one kid that likes the blueberries and one likes the raspberries. I mean, that's just what you know when you keep your kids on your radar. And, you know, this one likes the firm raspberries. And not because I asked them, but because I noticed, oh, Mom, these are really squishy. Yeah, texture's an issue for her. I know. Okay, those ones are in the freezer for a smoothie, right? But you keep your agenda to yourself. Food's a gift. It should be celebrated, as are relationships.
Okay, so I'm taking away that this is a much less stressful way of feeding our children.
I hope so. I think we have a lot of stress these days. Oh my goodness.
For the record, Corey is much better at this than I am. Corey, you win for this, I feel like.
Well, okay. Let me tell a really humbling story though. Back when my children were my poor older two guinea pigs, when they were younger, this is back when I was like first learning about nutrition and stuff. And I was so tense all the time, especially at meals. And, I like almost every meal would turn into a fight and I would be upset that nobody wanted to eat whatever I had made. And it was just awful. And at some point I'm somewhat of a picky eater and he always kind of has been. And at some point I realized, oh my gosh, I cannot live like this. I cannot keep coming to every single meal this stressed out. It is impossible. So my husband and I had a conversation about it. We had this chalkboard wall in our dining room. I ended up drawing this ginormous peace sign on it. And I just said, I'm not doing this anymore. And I took to heart Ellen Satter's, you know, division of responsibilities. I said, this is the meal. You may eat or you don't have to eat, but we are all going to sit down together. We are not even going to talk about the food aside from saying, oh, you know, this is a little spicy or this has, you know, sour cream on it. I really like the sour cream, or my husband hates sour cream. You know, like that's the conversation that we would have if we talked about food at all. And it changed our dinner time, meal times. It also changed the way that my oldest kid approached food. And he took him a long time, but he is now much more willing. So this is probably 6 years ago. He is now much more willing to try things when before he wouldn't have done it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, Corey and Christine. I love your honesty as well. It's so refreshing and that you struggle with this.
Oh, I definitely struggle with it because while you're talking about how important the relationship is and you mentioned a little bit about treats and things like that. And the first thing that comes to my head is, okay, wait a second. Everything is a treat nowadays. Like we celebrate all holidays and there's 50 birthdays in a school year. And I'm over here just thinking, how do we manage something like that? And that's an honest question because I don't want to create, and I actually want to talk a little bit about the counter will instinct that you bring up in your book, because I think this weaves in well with it. But how do we balance the counter will instinct, which you'll discuss, with the excessive overload of celebrations and treats all the time, and yet still let our kids have fun and yeah, I don't know.
I agree with you. I think it is completely excessive. When I remember at my daughter's school, they sent home a note saying, on your child's birthday, please do not bring in any sugar because the teachers don't appreciate it and the kids don't need it. No, and I thought, oh, and then I thought, no, They got cake at home. They got whatever they're doing. Like, it is a lot. And so I love those simple rules and rituals that the people who are responsible for thinking about this thought and took the lead on it. So no, you're right. And so you have to be on guard a little bit as a parent when it comes to the source of food, what's in food, if you have the luxury of that. That's for sure, because for some people that is a luxury. And there's also issues of food sovereignty. Whose food do we eat? Whose food is served? You know, you have some communities where you have indigenous populations, which are have genetic histories of being lactose intolerant, being shipped cartons of milk and cheese. And it's just like, no, they don't. That is not for them. But if you return them to their traditional diets of, you know, salmon and bannock, I mean, in any indigenous population, you see rates of health increase when you return to food sources that were part of their own history. And that's not simply a physical aspect, that's also psychological. So there is a absolute connection that we have to be thoughtful about, you know, how much sugar consumption in North America. I don't think there'd be anyone who would argue that. So yes, we have to be on guard for that. What I would say is that what has happened around food, because culture no longer protects us, is I think parents are now more alarmed about the food sources than, you know, perhaps once upon a time, and still for some people, it was about they don't have access to food. Now you have sort of an abundance, the quality of that can be debated. And people don't know what food to serve, what quantities, how to serve it, how to feed their kids, how to go from breast milk to solids. Like, we are so much in a deficit of information, knowledge, practices that was passed on for culture. So I am not surprised that what underlies, I think, the parental barriers here is basically the emotion of alarm. We are anxious when it comes to feeding our kids, or anxious not having enough, the right foods, or not knowing what to do. And it's that parental alarm that gets in the way of feeding our kids. And so when my alarm, and I think is what, I'm not sure if you would also agree with this, Corey, is when my alarm was about the relationship, that trumped my alarm around the food. And I thought, there is nothing that's going to work with food if I don't get this relationship right here. That is the key to serving and taking care of my kids. And so that became much greater a fear for me, is the fear of my relationship not being seen as a trustworthy caretaker. And so that's why it was easy for me to put that as a secondary agenda of what food to serve, and knowing that I would do my best to get it right as best as I could. But there is this whole instinct called counterwill, which is hardwired in, which is about resistance and opposition to being, when you feel coerced, that we have a knee-jerk reaction. The more immature you are, you have a knee-jerk reaction to do it yourself. No, you know, I don't want that. You say it, you know, you can see kids will just argue the opposite for almost no reason, or do the opposite of what's expected. And so I remember this really well as a child, you know, watching some very popular, you know, children's television program where they were trying to do their best to get kids to eat broccoli. Now, I love broccoli at that point, but I remember the character saying, oh, you have to eat broccoli. Broccoli's so good. Broccoli, yum, you know, and all the rest of it. And I'm thinking, something's up with broccoli. This guy's pushing the broccoli. Something must be up with that vegetable. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I became very wary. I didn't actually like the broccoli so much anymore. It took me a long time to like it again, because I felt very pushed and coerced. And I searched for research on this to say, are nutritional programs, direct programs to kids, eat this food, not this food, do they work? Instruction programs are not working. I could find no evidence. And in fact, it could be argued that it could make matters worse. It can have a temporary, perhaps, gain, but lost. The only time that, and so you can see this idea that we'll just educate any child, we don't necessarily have a relationship with them. They can feel very coerced. They do the opposite. So it's the same with sex. You start educating around, there's studies to show that the more you talk about sex, drugs, I don't know what it did for rock and roll. Certainly didn't hurt it. But you know, the more you talk about this, the more they want it. And so because we're not meant to be bossed around outside of people who don't know us. And we also, if we feel very pushed by our loved ones, we back up as a means of self-preservation and say, no, we won't do it. And that's where you get parents and kids in huge battles around the table. You'll have it one more bite because I said so. Clean off your plate. And you get this coercion and power struggles around food. Not only does the food and becoming an eater get impacted, but so does the relationship, and you've lost any buy-in. This child wants to do the same as you, follow your lead, eat the same as you, follow your values, whatever it might be. So resistance and opposition can emerge around anything. You'll learn to be a reader. You know, you're never going to try drugs. Like whatever it is, we can dig in, and kids will want to do the opposite. You have to have everything goes down. Like Mary Poppins had it right. Mind the sugar thing. But, you know, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. If you see sugar as relationship, as warmth, as caring, then I would say that is a wonderful way to look at it. So things have to happen in connection. When they studied, you know, how kids in Mexico acquire a taste for hot chili peppers at the age of 5, when at age 2, they hate it. Not even the animals will eat. The dogs will even eat the hot chili peppers if they're given, you know, if that's all there is, they'll eat it. The rats and the dogs will eat that from the garbage. But like the animals to the young children do not like the hot chili peppers. But why is it at 5 they're eating the hot chili peppers like their family does? And Paul Rosen, the researcher, the psychologist, said, we don't know the magic that happens between 2 and 5, but we know it happens at the table, where everybody's eating together, sharing the same food in different amounts, and the child is noticing and is part of that. But there is no coercion happening. There's just an invitation. And it's that invitation, that relationship that brings them in. So because North America has a very behaviorist learning paradigm that, quite ironically, has been deconstructed when it comes to discipline, when it comes to raising children and lots of other areas, even in education. Now it's being challenged in terms of how kids learn. When it comes to food, oh my goodness, it's like the last diehard area where we just don't get, you know, the more you focus on outcomes, the more you turn food into work. The less it's a gift, the less pleasurable it is. The more you focus on nutrition explicitly, the more kids can work to rule. Food becomes fuel. We lose the pleasure. They're less inclined to follow us. So the way that I look at it is all of this what we eat important? Absolutely. But it's a covert operation.
Got that, folks? Mission impossible.
This is where you have to insert like a little clip of music.
Totally. Like do 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 do.
Yeah, that's it. That's what
we don't need one as long as we have got Christine to make it for us. Okay, I think this is a quick question, but how does this work into the one bite to be polite, or, you know, that sort of thing?
Which you know the answer to that already.
I've never done that at my house, but I know that
one bite to be polite. Whose agenda is that? That makes me feel, that gets my counter well going. Like you said that to me. I'm like, what? I need to be polite now? Are you kidding me? Give me a break. Then this food isn't a gift. I'm sorry. Do you say that, Christine? Oh my God.
No, sometimes I'll say it, but actually I have a good friend who says it. And every time we go to her house, I love you, friend. She always tells my kids that. But that's, you know, that's totally okay. Every family does what, you know, they think.
Yeah, there's no prescription. I'm just telling you what happens inside of me. But when my friends come to my house, I try to think of what favorite alcoholic beverage they like. And I usually put that in their hands. So yeah. They don't seem to be too resistant to that.
That is not an option for children, people.
I said my friends.
Right. No, no, no. I know. Just to be very clear, so we don't have anybody coming after us.
No, but I would think, you know, like this kid likes, you know, doesn't like cheese. This kid likes this. And, you know, you're already anticipating what it is they like. When I have people around my table, I've already, you know, I'm already anticipating, or their allergies, or their different likes and preferences. You know, I don't necessarily, if I don't know them, I don't ask them directly. I'm doing a covert mission. I'm doing my intel so that when they come, there is no sense of politeness needed in the sense that I've tried to provide. You know, I ate lunch once with one of my indigenous elder, and my indigenous elders here in BC, I've been so fortunate to work and been invited to work in so many of their communities. And I listen because they hold so many stories about cultural ways of eating. And I remember one Indigenous elder, as I was eating lunch with her, she says, yeah, we don't say thank you or please when we pass things around the table. I'm like, oh, interesting. Why is that? And she said, because it's already believed that you're grateful. Mm. And you shouldn't have to beg for what you need. Mm. I'm just like, wow, did that ever school me, put me to rest? Yeah, what if I didn't have to beg people please and be polite and nice? And it was just assumed that I did care and that I was grateful and that I didn't have to use these words to put myself in submission to be cared for. What if there was just a generous provision and a provider who was there? It's like, wow, that feels a lot different to me.
Wow. Yeah, I like that. That's deep. Not to beat a dead horse. So you're saying not to talk about like the nutritional benefits of a food at the table. Definitely.
Well, I'm totally not really guilty of that. I'm not going to tell you what to do.
This is true. You did say that at the beginning.
I don't offer prescriptions here because culture, if you look around the world, you know, parents, you got to lead your own show. What I will say is that you do court food becoming more work. You do court counter will potentially. You know, is there value in it? There might be, you know, like, you know, I think about my daughter going to university and the fact that I never made quinoa and it is such a good food for you hasn't stopped her from finding quinoa and like, mom, look what I made. I'm like, wow, that's a really good meal. Like, where did you come from? And this is how I like to eat my quinoa. I'm like, yeah, that quinoa is wonderful. I'm like, yeah, I got to make more quinoa. Like, fill your boots. I don't know. She's figured it out, right? Because she likes finding and researching food, but she cares about herself. She cares about what she eats. She's on a budget for food. And so, like, how did she get there? Not because I taught her about food, but because she's mature and she cares. Like, that's the goal. If you get a kid to be mature and to care, you've got your problems like 95% solved. That's the key. Like, how many people fed themselves stuff that they would never feed their kids and had to learn how to cook, had to learn about food when they became a parent because they said, oh my gosh, I can't feed them champagne. I mean, I never lived on champagne, but I remember this one biography I read that was these two socialites in New York. I can't remember the book. And I was like, oh my God, like we just would go to, you know, appray things and have like champagne and canapes. And like, we couldn't feed our kids that. So we had to learn how to cook. And they like, I think they wrote a cookbook or something like this. And it was amazing. Why? Because they cared and they were mature and they found their way through. So just do the best you can with what you got and the resources that you have. Some parents are working, you know, full time outside the house and childcare and picking their kids up. And oh my goodness, like, just, we gotta, you know, the food shaming, the food police, like, let's just be a little careful and kind and considerate and appreciate that we're going to try to do the best we can for our kids with some caring and some maturity here and help those parents out, like have good food available and not have food deserts and things like that. Like that's what good social policy does, right? Is enables parents to have the resources to be able to make great choices for their families.
So you mentioned that, you know, you could be doing this even on the way to soccer or.
Yeah.
But I have a question about how should the parent who is, you know, has a very stressful job or even just had a really stressful day and they are, you know, just kind of like, oh, but I got to feed the kids, and they just throw something together. And even if they are sitting down together, they're still, you know, in this like high stress kind of state. Mm-hmm. How would you suggest approaching that from a parental's perspective?
Yeah, I love this question. It reminds me of my favorite chapter in the book, which is chapter 9. Well, chapter 10 was probably one of my favorites too. Mm-hmm. Chapter 9 on ritual. And see, what most food cultures did is eating, very much like sleep, is a time of rest. So if you said to parents, okay, what's your bedtime routine? I guarantee you, most parents will go like, oh, we have a bedtime routine and we do not deviate from it. Because if you deviate from it, if you miss the sleep window, especially with young kids, they're like, you can see the panic in the parents' eyes. No, we got a sleep routine. But sleep, why? Because it's a time of rest. The body has to be at rest in order to go to sleep. What if you applied that same mentality or mindset to eating? Like, your body doesn't. And this is the chapter on the gut feelings, right? The body, if it's not at rest, it doesn't digest. You can give it the best food possible. That child could eat everything. But if the body is not at rest, then the body can't absorb and use what is being supplied in the healthiest way possible. And so the gut works best when it's at rest. So we need ritual, we need routine, we need structure, we need some sort of consistency and emotional context in which we do our eating. You know, I have had families in my practice where it's been, you know, things have gotten dug in like a rut in a road and they can't get out of it. And the dinner table is just a nightmare. It's just emotions. People are already resistant. I say, well, I think we need a tactical retreat, you know, eat in the living room on a table around. I don't care where you eat. You know, what about if you eat on the floor like a picnic? The child actually had autism. And I said, why don't you, you know, eat under the table, eat on a, you know, picnic blanket, make it fun, make it play. And just do something different, because this environment is so laden with emotional distress. And set the stage, like, you know, what's your ritual? You come home, you're in your head. But see, that ritual helps you. As soon as you sit down, say, okay, this is my place to eat. Okay, park everything. You say your prayer, you say your blessing, you say thanks to Mother Nature, you know, good grub, bon appetit, whatever it is you say, slanchevé, whatever it is, whatever your thing is, then you do it as a means to start, you know, just like your bedtime routine. As soon as we start, you know, are winding in for a bedtime routine, we know our starting place, and then we know it's a march towards the end, the final end. So what's your starting place? What's your ritual? For me, it was everybody's at the table. Everybody is, there's no devices around. The food is there. Everybody waits till you try to anyway, before you start eating. Sometimes we get to a blessing, sometimes we didn't. You know, sometimes people had food in their mouths when we're doing blessings, whatever. It was imperfect at best, but, you know, I'd like the TV off. Sometimes my husband has the music on. Sometimes I try to light a candle. During COVID, I started bringing games to the table because I thought we need a little bit more. We need a little bit more connection. We need a little bit more play. We need a little bit more ritual just to create that extra place of rest. What are your cues? If it's in the morning, I've had, you know, single parents who just sit down with a cup of coffee with their kid while they eat breakfast cereal for 10, 15 minutes. They cue it up. Coffee, kids got cereal. I sit down and we chat. But that's how we protect what is important from the urgent. All that work stuff is out here. You got to create a bubble for rest. Your rituals, your structure, routine is what helps you enter into that state and what helps your child join you and feel like they're in that bubble of security and safety and of rest. And then what do you say at the end? Okay, grub is done, you know, clean up your plates. And then you can feel everybody like, oh, okay, back to work. And so it has a beginning and it has an end. But that's the best way, because if you don't have some rituals and routines to help you shift gears, it's very difficult, especially with the competing things that we have to pay attention to and stuff that we bring home that's in our head. So I hope that helps, but that's been, I think that's been the most helpful suggestion that I've ever given any family is treat it like the bedtime routine. There's a beginning, there's an end. Do what you need to do, but make it fun, make it connection, make it playful. It could be quiet, it could be loud, it could be whatever you want, but just a beginning and an end and set up some ritual and routine.
I love that idea of relating it to the bedtime routine. It never occurred to me. It's brilliant. I didn't really learn a lot about rituals until my oldest went to a Waldorf school. And Waldorf schools are very, very big on routine and specifically ritual around a table. I mean, it is an entire, it's an event when you bring, you know, 15 3 to 6 year olds at a table together to eat the same meal. There was always rituals involved.
And what, and that's just what should be so natural to us. And oh my goodness, when you look at how our kids eat in institutional settings, it's just heartbreaking. Yeah. In, you know, some of the school lunch halls look like what you'd find in a prison. And the behavior is quite similar as well. In preschools, this idea that children have to regulate their bodies at 3 and know when they need a body break, and it's so disconnected. They don't eat together. The child's supposed to go get their own food. It's like, do you not understand anything about a young child? They are not regulated. They're the most impulsive, reactive, untempered, inconsiderate, aggressive time of life. They don't even stop playing to go to the bathroom. They do pee-pee dance. They're not going to stop for a bite of food. Food's overrated when you have play. Like, there's just no wisdom around this. And then you get these little pockets, like the Waldorf school, who just protects this and sets this up as just, it's always been this way. And it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's the way we need to have so much care. People say, oh, well, you know, it's just food. What does it really mean? It's about human connection. It's about rest. It's about that child trusting you. You know, it's what you do around food communicates to the child who you are as a caretaker. It's the place you show up the most. Who are you as a caretaker? People go right to food. Who fed me? How did they feed me? What were their intentions? I asked everybody in my research, Christine, remember this in reading it, does food have love in it? Everybody in my studies, hundreds of people, all agreed food can have love in it or be embodied with love. And when it doesn't taste as good and they don't want to eat it. And when it is, it's because someone's paid time and attention. They've got caring intentions and there's caring and warmth attached to it. And they feel nourished. You don't even have to, your food might not even taste that good. But if it's made with love, people said, it tastes good. Which I thought was, see, yay for me. This is where I needed this research. It was made with love. Okay, Mom. But this idea here, like who you are as a caretaker, your kids are watching you, and there's nowhere more consistent than bedtime every night and also the provision of food. And that sets the tone for trust, for reliability, consistency, permanence, exclusivity. You want to hold on to your kids in a digital world? Feed them in a way that's exclusive and personal.
Wow. I don't know how we can end on that note. Corey.
Yes.
Do you have any other questions or any thoughts?
I mean, I think that there's so much freedom in what we're talking about. And I know I already said it's less stressful, but there's, you know, I think Christine and I run in a crowd of people who are very stressed out about what we're feeding our kids. I think that they are also, for the most part, very aware of trying to, you know, have a safe home environment and nourishing home environment for their children. I do think that that is a high priority for most people in our crowd. And I think that it's difficult to, as you know, Christine and I are both millennial parents, and it's really difficult to be kind of doing things differently than the way we were raised. I know, Christine, you talk about this a lot more than I do because we had different childhoods, but, you know, we're kind of relearning things intentionally as we go. I know I have, like I already said, my two older kids are my guinea pigs because, and God bless them. I mean, I'm an oldest child. I know what it's like to be the guinea pig kid.
That's why we're neurotic. The firstborns are always neurotic. I'm neurotic.
I know.
Well, yeah.
So you must know I'm a firstborn then.
Yeah. I want people to come away from this going, okay, I can breathe. I don't have to be, you know, as stressed out as I always am around food. And even if that means, you know, there's an electric blue cupcake at a birthday party, which is going to be a massive trigger point for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
when you see the color of their stool the next day, you're like, what happened?
Right.
Oh my God. The first time I saw that, I'm like, I think, what disease is this? And then I remembered, oh my God, it was the blue ice cream they had. Oh yeah. Okay. Well, wow. That can't be good for them. Wow.
Yeah.
But I think your question is a good one. And you know what? I never try to talk any parent out of their emotion. You have a right to your emotion. So don't let me try to talk you out of it. But what I would say to you is that I believe you've got this. I believe and trust in you as a parent. Oh my goodness. Your diligence, your responsibility, your care for your children is beautiful. Just don't forget to care to the same degree about your relationship, and make sure you put it first. Make sure you put it first, because I got to tell you that your worries about what they will eat is solved through your relationship. You've got it covered. If you're worried about that kind of stuff around food and blue cupcake and icing, you're paying attention. Like, I'm not worried about you paying attention. You've got kids on your radar. You've got, you know, dye, blue dye, whatever that is on your radar, like, good for you. But you can't lose sight of also what's more important in raising a child, which is your relationship. So let the relationship lead. And, you know, I knew I was ready to write this book when I realized this, which was that there is a platitude. And I took down tons of cliches and myths and the table and, oh my gosh, I had to go through so much picky eating and just reconstructed, deconstructed and reconstructed. It was a labor of love, trust me. But this one in particular, this eat together, eat together, eat together. I'm like, oh, I am not writing another book about eating together. Jeez Louise, if everybody knows this. It's what's interesting. The interesting question is, why aren't we doing it? And then I realized we got this wrong. It's not eat together. In eat together, the food comes first. Eat, it's focusing on the food and then togetherness. It's gather first, then eat. That is what we've got to get. So if you know, yes, you're going to get the food stuff covered. Keep it to yourself, covert operation. They're going to follow you if they're attached to you. And you know what? Even if you don't feed them quinoa, they might actually eat quinoa down the road. Like, they're going to discover a whole world, become their own eater on their own as well. Your job is to get them across the finish line to have healthy bodies and healthy relationships. But gather first and then eat. Gather is a beautiful word. It's a word of human attachment. It's about human connection. It is about the thing that is the most critical for survival. And it doesn't end at the grave. Death is not a barrier to love. This is the answer to longevity. You know, when I was looking at the Holy Grail and this whole idea of the pursuit of the Holy Grail and longevity, what I realized is that the Grail or gradualis, you know what it means in Latin?
No.
It means the dish that serves everyone. What is the answer to longevity? Your togetherness. That's the answer. It's not what's on the dish. It's the fact that the dish serves everybody, brings everybody together. It's like we can't even get the Holy Grail story right. It's about what's in the freaking cup or on the plate. The answer to longevity is love. The plate brings people together that love each other or will be put into relationship with each other. So that would be my answer to your parents. Don't change who you are. That caring is a beautiful part of you. Just make sure you let love lead and be bigger than the fear that you have about the food.
I feel like that could be a catchy song. Let love lead.
You will have to write the lyric. You will have to write the melody to that.
I'll put my husband on it. Wow, that was such a good note to end on. Corey, what do you think?
Absolutely. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Oh, my
God. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
My pleasure. It's been a delight.
Deborah, do you just want to tell people real quick where they can find you?
Sure. They can find me in all the usual suspect places. So I have a website. I have a Facebook, Instagram. I also have a Substack, which I will be working on a little bit more. A Substack newsletter called Gather to Eat, which I will be dedicating just to food issues and will be hopefully adding to that over the summer a little bit more. And a course on Gather to Eat, I hope, as I put more of these pieces together in the fall. And, but yeah, you can find me in lots of those places.
I'm embarrassed to say I had never been on your website before until I was doing, you know, the research for this, and oh my goodness, is your website a treasure trove of information. So for anyone who just, I feel like you answer all of the common parenting questions in, you know, quick little articles on there. Yeah. I definitely went down a rabbit hole and there was one that said something along the lines of like 5 things you shouldn't say to your kids or something like that. I had definitely completed 4 of the 5 and was like, well, okay, that's it. I'm done.
Listen, where do you think I get the material from? I would have been guilty of all 5 easily. So yeah, no, it's just the nature of the beast, right?
Yeah. But
thank you anyway. For that.
Thank you.
Okay. And your 2 books are called?
Rest, Play, Grow, Making Sense of Preschoolers or Anyone Who Acts Like One. And this book about food and human connection is called Nourished, Connection, Food, and Caring for Our Kids and Everyone Else We Love.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you so much again. Christine, do you have anything else to say?
No, this was awesome. I'm giddy with excitement at how much fun this conversation was and how cool I feel that I got to talk to you.
I'm delighted to talk to both of you. And oh my goodness, this is what millennial parents look like. We are in good hands.
Oh, thanks. Okay, I think we are going to wrap it up, sign off.
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
I know. Have a great night. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Modern Ancestral Mamas. Check out the show notes for the resources. You can find Christine on Instagram at NourishTheLittles and online at NourishTheLittles.com. You can find Corey on Instagram at ForNutrientsSake and online at ForNutrientsSake.com. Follow us on Instagram at Modern Ancestral Mamas.
Opinions expressed in this episode are those of the guests. They do not reflect Corey and I's and Modern Ancestral Mama's personal views and opinions. We do not take responsibility for any ideas expressed during the podcast interview.
The information contained in this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended to be medical advice and should not replace your relationship with your healthcare practitioner.